Today is Friday, January 25th, 2019, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Bertel in Washington. Coming up, a close friend of U.S. President Donald Trump is indicted in the Russian investigation. The partial U.S. government shutdown is into its second month, and the public is beginning to be impacted. And we'll visit Amazon's headquarters in Seattle. It's all on today's International Edition. Roger Stone, a campaign advisor to U.S. President Donald Trump, has been arrested on several criminal charges today. The charges are related to the special counsel's investigation of Russian interference in the 2016 U.S. national election. Joining me is VOA's Masoud Farivar, who has been covering the Russia investigation. Masoud, thank you for being here. What is Stone accused of?
Thank you, Jim. So the charges against them, the seven counts included in the indictment, stem from a testimony that he gave to the House Intelligence Committee back in September of 2017. During the testimony, he was asked about his interactions with WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks, during the 2016 campaign. And he is accused of making false statements about his interactions with WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. He's also accused of obstructing justice and tampering with a witness. And that involves getting a close associate of his to also lie to Congress about the role that he played in facilitating this interaction with Julian Assange, between Julian Assange and Roger Stone.
Earlier today, White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders addressed the charges against Stone, saying they are unrelated to the president.
This doesn't have anything to do with the president, doesn't have anything to do with the White House.
All right, Masoud, does this have anything to do with the president?
Directly, no. Indirectly, yes. Remember, Roger Stone has been a longtime friend, associate, and advisor of the president. He was not involved with the campaign. He was not an official member of the campaign during the time that the alleged interactions between him and Julian Assange and WikiLeaks took place. But he was working on behalf of the campaign. He was campaigning for the president through a super PAC that he created. And, among other things that helped pay for this famous billboard showing Trump as Superman in Times Square. And he also made a number of media appearances, was active on social media, and actively working for the president's campaign. So what the indictment shows is that he was in close contact with Trump campaign officials. In fact, was asked by a Trump campaign official to find out more about the WikiLeaks plans to release damaging emails about Hillary Clinton and her campaign chairman, John Podesta.
The special counsel's investigation has been methodical with indictments, and they've been seemingly getting closer and closer to Mr. Trump's inner circle. Do we have reason to believe there will be more indictments?
I think there are indications that there will be more indictments. Roger Stone's indictment was, of course, widely expected. He had hinted and said in recent weeks that he would be indicted. A couple of other people who have also suggested that they would be indicted are Jerome Corsi and another Roger Stone associate, who also played a role in the whole WikiLeaks episode. And finally, the president's eldest son, Don Jr., has said that he also expects to be indicted. We don't know who else will be indicted, but all expectations are that we will likely some indictments in the coming weeks.
Okay. Well, we've been watching this play out for almost 2 years. Where do things go from here?
Well, additional indictments probably, but there's also an expectation that the special counsel, Robert Mueller, has probably hit the home stretch and is working on a final report. We don't know what kind of a final report it will be. When it's prepared, it will be given to the Attorney General, and a version of that report will be probably shared with Congress. But in the meantime, it appears that the special counsel is still busy seeking testimonies, statements, and probably working on additional indictments.
Masoud Farivar, we appreciate your insight into this important investigation.
Thank you, Jim.
And this is International Edition. Among the top stories in the world, the UN rights chief is calling for talks to defuse the situation in Venezuela. Two human rights groups are urging Saudi Arabia to allow international monitors to investigate allegations human rights activists have been tortured. U.S. Africa Command says it will again release the number of enemy fighters killed and damage information caused from its airstrikes. Rights groups say they are worried about deteriorating human rights in Zimbabwe. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
We know that certain colors can influence how a food product should taste. Like when we're about to drink a yellow-colored beverage, many of us probably think we're about to taste something tart like lemonade. Penn State University researchers Molly Higgins and John Hayes wanted to find out how people learn to associate colors with tastes and whether they could be taught to link colors with completely different tastes. Over four sessions, the researchers got subjects to sip liquids with new colors they had specifically selected, avoiding any preconceived color taste pairings. Then the subjects were given uncolored liquids and were asked to pair each flavor with the new colors. It turns out the subjects picked the correct color taste match 59% of the time. The research will be published in the journal Food Quality and Preference. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
And you're listening to VOA's International Edition. We still have many more stories to come, including the latest on the U.S. government shutdown, its impact on the border, and also coming up, we're going to visit Amazon's headquarters in Seattle, just as it names two new secondary headquarters in New York City and Washington, D.C. Well, the partial U.S. government shutdown is into day 35. Many government workers have now missed two paychecks, leaving some facing financial hardship, and yet several hundred thousand are deemed essential and being forced to work. Joining me to discuss the latest developments in the shutdown is VOA's congressional correspondent, Catherine Gibson. Catherine, glad to have you with us. We're seeing the shutdown's impact at airports across the country today. What's happening?
That's right. The impact at airports today all up and down the East Coast is something that lawmakers up here on Capitol Hill have been saying for weeks could possibly be the tipping point in ending the impasse over the shutdown. We're seeing delays of a couple hours in key airports around the New York City area, and that's really for the first time giving a sense to people outside of the Washington, D.C. area, some who may not be federal workers, of the impact of the shutdown. So up here on Capitol Hill, I've been hearing from lawmakers who are saying that this could help end the impasse.
Well, that's what's happening today. Let's go back to yesterday because it was a very impactful day. The Senate voted on two separate bills to reopen the government. Tell us about these.
That's right. So they basically had two options before them. One was President Trump's proposal, which would have given some limited immigration reforms, along with funding for the border wall in return for funding the government through the end of the fiscal year. The other Democratic proposal would have been a short-term funding bill, just reopening the government for a couple of weeks, getting those federal workers paid, but not giving the president any money for his border wall. Now, we know that, of course, both of those proposals failed, but afterwards, there was some movement up here on Capitol Hill, a sense that because those proposals failed, they needed to get going on a backup option.
Well, working on a backup option and coming up with an actual agreement could be a long way apart. Are there credible negotiations going on at the moment, or was it just a photo op?
No, there certainly are some closed-door meetings between Democratic and Republican leadership on the Senate side trying to hammer out something. The thinking up here is that it would be another three-week short-term funding bill that would just get the shutdown over with, get people paid, and really show that, you know, Republicans need some movement on this issue. The problem is that right now we're waiting on the White House. Republican leadership is saying that it's up to the White House to decide what they will negotiate for and what they will reopen the government for. So right now we're in a little bit of a holding pattern up here.
Well, that's a very good point. If the president isn't going to sign whatever Congress comes up with, it really is a futile effort. Has President Trump shown any signs of compromise in the last 24 hours?
Nothing that we've seen yet, but the thinking is that because he backed down from that State of the Union issue with Nancy Pelosi, you may remember that she disinvited him from giving the State of the Union address, which was set to be next week. There's some thinking that he's starting to realize that this shutdown is having an impact, and certainly seeing these ground stops and delays in major airports up and down the East Coast should have some effect.
Well, we have about 30 seconds left. We've probably seen more negotiations going on in the last 24 hours than in the last 5 weeks. Is there a reason to think that the shutdown could end soon?
That is the general sense up here, that because Democratic and Republican leadership are finally meeting with each other, we're hearing from Mitch McConnell and Chuck Schumer, we're seeing these stops in the airports. The sense is that, you know, federal employees have now missed their second paycheck this month, is that there has to be some sort of tipping point here. The pressure is just building to an intense level.
VOA's congressional correspondent, Catherine Gibson, thanks once again for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Meanwhile, a number of former national security officials, both Republican and Democrat, have written a letter to the White House and Congress warning that the shutdown is a danger to national security and warned the government must be reopened immediately. Joining my colleague Lori London earlier today was Robert Dietz, professor of government affairs at George Mason University. She asked him how serious is the concern to national security.
I think it's very serious. It's not so much the funding per se. What it is that people are not working. And when they're working, they're doing significant things. For example, if things with Russia get really serious, what kind of military planning are we doing? If things get serious with China, what kinds of things are we doing in anticipation? I would be really surprised if we do not begin seeing actions by China or Russia to sort of nibble around the edges to see what our reactions are going to be. And so I think it's very serious. And I think what's particularly serious is I'm not expecting a sneak attack or anything like that, but training takes place, and that's not being done. Research and development on weaponry and defensive weaponry is not being done. We're not just talking about federal employees who aren't working. We're also talking about all the contractors. That's very serious. In addition, this sort of thing is demoralizing for workers. Mm-hmm. And I've read articles, I'm sure you have as well, about federal workers now idle who are beginning to look at the private sector. And so I think the combination of these factors is very dangerous. That's 7 weeks. That's a lot of time. Right. Bear in mind that, you know, all of us in various jobs from time to time have been required to work really long hours. But that's not day after day after day after day. You know, you recognize I'm going through this high stress level, but that'll be done in a week or two.
Yes.
This has been going on now for 5 weeks, mm-hmm. and you cannot expect people to work at anywhere near their normal levels of quality. Right. And so, yeah, I think it's incredibly dangerous. But again, this is 1/12 of the year. You just can't lose 1/12 of a year without noticing it.
This whole thing is started because the president is trying to make a case that in order to have national security, we need a border wall. But at the same time, the shutdown seems to be posing an even greater national security risk.
Most people that look at the border issue don't believe that it's an emergency or even a serious security concern. Most analysts think that the bulk of illegal drugs, illegal chemical weapons and so on come through airports, you know, come through controlled places, not being snuck across the border between Mexico and the United States.
But then you point back to the air, and we've got the TSA security agents that are in charge of screening,
yes,
that are calling in sick in record numbers,
yep,
and upset and angry and can't pay their bills. And
yep,
I've heard stories of people getting through the lines with things and getting on planes with things they shouldn't be getting on.
Certainly it's troubling on the merits, but personalities have entered it in this dispute in a very large and unwholesome way. The president deciding first that he's going to hold the State of the Union someplace and then deciding not. So clearly there's animus between him and Speaker Pelosi, and I don't think that's likely to help this problem get solved.
How much longer do you think something like this can go on without doing really serious damage to our security, our economy, that could have an impact for years to come?
It is a great question. I read an article that Mr. Mulvaney was talking about agencies making plans for shutdown lasting into March. I find that really, really threatening to our national security and, as you say, to our economy. I don't know what the total number of people who are not getting paid is. I know the government figure is about 800,000, but then there are the so-called Beltway bandits, the various consulting firms around Washington. But then in addition to that are all the merchants who are not getting paid as much as they would if there were not this shutdown. And at some point, that becomes a serious amount of money.
Robert Dietz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University. While the border wall continues to be a sticking point in negotiations to end the partial U.S. government shutdown, beginning today, the Trump administration tackles the influx of migrants at the southern border with a new policy. Reuters' Eve Johnson reports.
While U.S. President Donald Trump's border wall has the government mired in a shutdown, his administration is moving on another front. The U.S. plans to send asylum seekers back across the southern border, with the first group set to arrive in the Mexican border city of Tijuana on Friday. The new policy requires migrants to wait for a ruling on their asylum cases in Mexico, a major shift in policy. The so-called Migrant Protection Protocols, or MPP, was first unveiled late last year to a storm of protest from rights groups. But according to the Department of Homeland Security, the MPP will help curb the number of people crossing into the U.S. illegally.
They will not be able to disappear into the United States. They will have to wait for approval to come into the United States. If they are granted asylum by a U.S. judge, they will be welcomed into America. If they are not, they will be removed to their home countries.
The MPP targets migrants from Central American countries and may make some exemptions for children traveling on their own or people from, quote, vulnerable populations. The government is struggling to handle a backlog of more than 800,000 asylum cases, a process that can take years. Meanwhile, it's not clear how Mexico plans to deal with the asylum seekers while they wait for a judge to decide their fate. There are also safety fears for the migrants, with some Mexican border towns more violent than the cities they left behind. The policy is likely to be challenged in court, since claiming asylum is protected under both international and U.S. law.
That's Reuters' Eve Johnson reporting. And you're listening to VOA's International Edition.
What is it like to study in the United States? And what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. There are signs of progress in the ongoing peace talks between the United States and the Taliban in Qatar. This is leading some to think they could set the stage for a politically negotiated settlement to the 17-year-old war in Afghanistan. AP's Karen Chamis reports one encouraging sign is the appointment of a new head of the Taliban's political office in Qatar.
Abdul Ghani Baradar, a senior Taliban military commander, was arrested in Pakistan in 2010 and released in October 2018. His release is believed to have been arranged by the United States as part of the negotiations, and his presence could reassure battlefield commanders who may fear concessions by the political leadership. U.S. Envoy Zalmay Khalilzad has met with the Taliban on a number of occasions in recent months in the latest bid to end America's longest war. The U.S. State Department has neither denied nor confirmed previous meetings with the Taliban, but Khalilzad says he has met with all sides in the conflict. I'm Karen Chamas.
This is VOA's International Edition. This year's World Economic Forum Summit in Davos, Switzerland, has some notable absentees, including U.S. President Donald Trump. With backlash against a perceived ruling elite gaining ground in many countries, some leaders are steering clear of a gathering often seen as an inaccessible club for the world's super-rich. But others say it is vital they get together to discuss urgent issues like climate change. Henry Ridgewell reports.
There's been a lot of scientific research that shows that when you are surrounded by green, surrounded by nature, your brain works a little bit differently. Maybe it thinks more creatively. So we're really excited to give our employees this opportunity to come in here to work in a place that feels a little bit different, that feels really refreshing, and also to educate them on all of the different types of plants that are here from all over the world.
There are over 40,000 plants from more than 50 countries inside the biodomes. Here, Amazon employees can sit in a cozy nest or conduct a staff meeting under a cocoa tree. Tim Bomke is a program manager at Amazon.
That takes a little bit of getting used to. But I think for me at least, I really enjoy that adds to the freedom and the creativity that you have. It's the first building that we've done where you don't have a desk. It's just kind of all free spaces. And, you know, if you are an early bird, you can pretty much, you know, pick where you want to work.
Even the company's more conventional office buildings have interesting cozy workspaces. For instance, one can play chess or shuffleboard or lock themselves in a phone booth to get some privacy during a phone conversation, while others might enjoy spaces like this amphitheater, where they can work and watch something fascinating on TV. And other stands offer free bananas. Those who distribute them are affectionately called banistas. But it's not just people who enjoy this unusual space. About 6,000 dogs also come to work in Amazon, or rather, accompany their owners, like Amy Zawowski.
It's really nice, especially like even like a stress reliever. You know, he just comes and, you know, pet him. A lot of people will stop by my desk, not to see me, but to see JoJo.
Blake Ferry's dog, Gus, pretty much grew up at Amazon.
The first week when he was a puppy was a bit of a challenge just because he wanted to meet everyone. But once he settled down, no problems at all.
And that was not Henry Ridgewell taking us to Davos. It was, in fact, a tour of Amazon headquarters in Seattle. And Amazon will be constructing two alternate headquarters sites, one in New York City and one just outside of the nation's capital in the near future. Many are expecting these sites to be just as innovative as the original. Well, that does it for this edition of International Edition. You can find us by visiting us online at voanews.com or on the VOA mobile app. Thanks for joining us, and my thanks to our studio team, Jackson Wanganyi, also engineer Patrick Dea, and I'm Jim Bertel in Washington. Have a great weekend.
The 2019 VOA calendars are in. This year's calendar features a variety of scenic photos that capture U.S. byways. including beautiful photos of the Big Sur Coast Highway and even the historic Route 66. Tune in to Border Crossings at 1500 Universal to request a free calendar. Stand up!